Good evening. This is Janet Sanders, Assistant Dean of Women at Kansas University. Welcome to A Feminist Perspective. This weekly radio broadcast is sponsored by the Women's Resource and Career Planning Center, a program and information service of the Dean of Women's Office, 220 Strong Hall. A Feminist Perspective provides a forum for women themselves to speak publicly on issues of concern to them and helps inform other women and men of the movement which is remaking the shape and substance of women's and men's lives. The Women's Resource and Career Planning Center contains large amounts of information, news clippings, government documents, magazine articles, research studies, and books pertaining to the many aspects of the women's movement. We would like to invite you to come in and browse or take advantage of the materials which can be borrowed. That's in 220 Strong Hall at the University of Kansas. Tonight's program is part of a continuing series on choice and sexuality. Our specific topic tonight is infringement on choice. We have two guests, Ms. Jill Quitley, who is a senior in the Kansas University School of Social Welfare, and Casey Eike, who is assistant to the Dean of Women at Kansas University. I think that the general orientation I had in mind for infringement on choice would be the kinds of things that operate in the world today that prevent women, especially, from exercising and expressing their sexuality as they might choose to. The things that keep women from being aware of the possible alternatives, that frown on some of the alternatives, or make it impossible for them to utilize some of the alternatives to expressing their sexuality. And I guess the thing that comes to mind, first of all, as a clear infringement on choice, is rape. Rape is legally defined as carnal knowledge of a person, usually a woman, against her will. Casey, I think you've been doing some work on rape statistics around the country.
Right. I think it's interesting to note that in 1970, there were 37,270 reported rapes. In 1972, there were 41,890 reported rapes. And most criminologists that I have read estimate that between four and ten times as many rapes that occur as are reported. The FBI has indicated that rape is the least reported crime of all.
Any hypotheses about why that might be?
Well, I think we could all come up with our own hypotheses, but the one thing that comes to my mind first is that it's such a hard thing for the woman to go through the actual reporting procedure and having to relive the situation perhaps many different times through different questionings, and the idea that's kind of inherent in our culture, that it's kind of the woman's fault that she was raped. I think that a lot of women grow up with this attitude, and still, even though they intellectually may know that that's not her fault and that this is something done to her, a crime committed against her person, I think she still has to deal with some inner guilt feelings, and many times these in subtle ways she has to deal with it in herself, but I think in lots of times in more overt ways when during questioning, say, the kinds of questions that you're asked, and you know, why were you on the street at that time, you know, or why were you in this bar getting a beer, things like that. That she really has to delve into herself and dig out those feelings.
What about this community itself? Is rape much of a problem in Lawrence?
Well, it's a problem everywhere, and Lawrence is no different, really. It's a smaller town, of course, so there's not as many, but last year, in 1972, there were 26 reported rapes in the city of Lawrence and over 200 assaults of all types. Again, there is no way of really knowing how many rapes actually occurred during that time period. And it also depends on how you define rape. I think, you know, we can all think of very obvious examples. You know, if a woman is accosted and forced
dragged into an alley.
Right,
and
right. Things like that would, you know, we would all agree is rape. But I think that we might talk about the topic on infringement and talk about some more subtle kinds of rape, or I don't know if there's a different way to term it, but it could be termed rape also.
I'm thinking right now about the more violent and obvious kind of thing, and thinking of that as an infringement of another kind of choice. I'm remembering some women saying that they feel that their territory is very limited. For example, some of the streets around campus are not safe for a woman after dark, and that is infringing their choice just as when do they go to the library. Jill, I see you nodding. Do you share this feeling?
Yeah, I share the feeling, you know, as a woman student, and sometimes out, you know, at the street at night, you know, there comes that feeling and a little bit of that fear. And I really resent that, you know, the fact that I am not free to walk around safely and comfortably. You know, I still do it, you know, but there definitely is that fear.
I think we all are. Raised with that fear, and for good reason, because the problem exists, and it's something that we should be aware of. But I experience the same kinds of frustration and kind of anger at why do I have to be afraid to walk down the street by myself?
I'm wondering something about this fear of rape, because thinking back through my own upbringing, that seemed to be something that was really very, very much to be feared. It keeps me and kept me from going out at night by myself and doing things that I really wanted to do. And yet when I sit down and think about it objectively, then I can think, well, so long as he doesn't kill you or maim you, you know, there seems to be a lot worse things in the world than being raped. And yet that is really, for women, seems to be a great bugaboo, a great thing to be terribly afraid of.
But I think I have read something a woman wrote about that particular topic, that she said that in many cases, you know, it's better to be raped than to be mauled to be maimed for life or killed or whatever. But I wish I could remember her exact words, because they really impressed me. But she said that it's the idea I wish I could think of the right words, but the infringement on her person, the intimate and the highest form of insult, I think, is what she meant by her phrasing. And that she said that it was the same feeling when she thought about rape as she had when she read about the British woman who was tarred and feathered.
In Northern Ireland.
Right, right. And for, the insult
for
done and the
dating a British soldier, of the Irish insurgents cut her hair in tarred and feathered.
Right, and even though the tar would come off and wash off and her hair would probably grow back, there was no way to replace that, the loss of respect for herself or the kind of harm that was done to her person.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about to her reputation? Do you think that, in 1973... people would look at a woman who had been raped with, you know, she loses her reputation if she has been raped? I remember seeing some movies from the 40s she couldn't hold her head up in the community again, that kind of thing.
Well, I think that might be part of it. I mean, there has to be some reason why women, you know, keep this to themselves. And I think part of it is some kind of a feeling of guilt and at least a feeling on their part, no matter how justified it is today, that other people will look at her somehow as being to blame or somehow as being different even, you know, maybe not even to blame. Maybe they see her as, just it's too bad it happened, but, you know, since it has, well, you know, just somehow that she's different. My intellectual reaction would be, you know, I don't think that's too common anymore, but, you know, I'm sort of struggling to find out why exactly it is that women are so reluctant, not only to inform the police, you know, but just to go to the hospital or to tell parents about
it. Or to tell anyone. There have been lots of cases where the woman doesn't tell anyone until several years or 10 years later in a CR group. I know this one example.
Consciousness raising
group, sorry. She finally admitted in her group, once they started talking, she felt comfortable. She could finally admit that, yes, this had happened to her 10 years ago, but she had never told anyone about it. I think that's a good example of that kind of thing, too. I also think that's changing. The more that women talk about rape and it's more out in the open, and the more that women learn about the injustice, say, inherent in our legal system, about rape, and if we can develop a healthy anger about the whole situation, I think that more and more women will report and talk about rape and go to counselors about, you know, if they've been raped and talk about it and get those feelings out.
I think support from other women is growing, and just locally in town with the rape victim counselors being set up, and being able to call up a woman who is sympathetic to what, you know, the rape victim is must be feeling, and who maybe has had contact with being assaulted herself, even or dealing with other women who have been assaulted, and just being able to talk about it openly.
Right. Yeah. I'm thinking that might be one of the ways that women, in some ways, box themselves into losing their freedom of choice. The idea that you don't talk to other people about sexual matters, and I think that. Okay, I'm 27, and I'm remembering being a teenager in my very early 20s. Lots and lots of questions about my sexuality, about wanting to compare my experiences with other people. But you just don't talk about that kind of thing. At least we didn't then, or in the groups of friends that I was in. And so it must be very difficult when you can't even talk about the usual things that happen to bring up something like this. And I think some of this closeness can account for losing choices if you don't choose to be open about it. What you were saying earlier, Casey, about the more covert types of rape, not the kind where a man drags the woman into the alley and tears her clothes off and rapes her, but...
Well, I'm thinking of situations that I've as though it never happened to me that I can remember right now anyway. But the kinds of situations where, say, a freshman girl is going out with the neat guy or something, and maybe he expects her to put out for him, and she kind of expects that he expects that, and although she hasn't really thought about it and made a conscious decision, she's kind of led into that because she feels that it's expected, and he may feel that she expects it, and all these expectations.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of thing where there isn't a conscious choice. I mean, you don't consciously decide what you want to do. I think that's an infringement on people choosing.
Mm-hmm. I would define it that way. Part of my responsibilities as human sexuality advisor to the Commission on the Status of Women includes problem pregnancy counseling. And so often the women that I talk with who find themselves with an unwanted pregnancy say it's something that just happened. I really hadn't been expecting it. I hadn't been thinking about it. It just happened. And they don't appear particularly happy about that. They hadn't given it any thought, and afterwards they just worried a lot, and it did have bad results for them.
You know, I think there are a couple of things that lead to that, and I think one of them is that inability to talk about sex openly. I mean, even mm-hmm. when that freshman girl is dating, you know, her boyfriend, it's very hard to even bring up the possibility of whether they will have sex or not. So that, you know, even when it appears that they will be, you know, imminently or whatever,
uh-huh.
it's still very hard to say, you know, wait. I mean, it's just it's so hard to verbalize around mm-hmm. around the whole sexual sphere.
For sure.
And when you can't verbalize, you can't even express that, you know, you're not ready, you're not protected, you're not anything. I mean, so there's that. I think a lot of lack of talking about it,
mm-hmm. which makes for a lack of choice. Mm-hmm. Do you think that there's anything still going on like we used to see in cartoons? You know, the fellow who drives the woman out to the country after a date and says, you know, either get your roller skates on and skate home or put out now. For example, here at the University of Kansas, do you think that there's that kind of mentality going on?
Boy, I'd hate to answer that, but, you know, I don't have any way of knowing. But I wouldn't be that surprised. Just given the way that we were all raised and that the kinds of expectations that we're all subject to.
Mm-hmm. that seems to me somewhere in the middle ground between the very overt dragging someone in the alley and the just happening kind of thing. But,
right.
but where some, where a man has a specific intent in mind and gives a woman really not too much choice if she wants to walk 7 miles back to Lawrence at 3 o'clock in the morning in the dark and the cold. That isn't too much of a viable choice.
I had a roommate, actually, a couple years ago who had that kind of an experience. It was not on campus. It was when she went home. And so I think it still is happening, mm-hmm. definitely.
All right. Well, my thoughts are moving into yet another more subtle kind of denial of choice, and that's just kind of a societal denial. In some of the readings that I've been doing on sexuality, people are becoming very conscious that both women and men have had their choices limited by society's expectations, that there is only one proper, healthy, normal way of expressing your sexuality, and so of course that is the only one that you will consider and that is the only one that you will practice. I like to call that the heterosexual American dream ideal, which Dr. Lonnie Myers of the Institute for the Study of Sexuality in Chicago talked about and described as an adult male and female, preferably married, preferably white, preferably in their own double bed after 10 o'clock with the lights out and quietly so the children don't hear, and the man on top. That is being the heterosexual American dream ideal. And anything else, any other expression of sexuality, is not good for your body, it's not good for your mind, and it definitely isn't good for your soul. And so that to me seems clearly to be cutting out a lot of possible alternatives for sexual expression.
Did she go on to talk about the reasons why this, you know, what keeps this ideal going?
Well, she laid quite a bit of the blame on the medical profession. The medical profession, who itself is ill-informed about sexuality, who finds difficulty, a physician who finds difficulty, as Jill pointed out, in communicating about sex to a patient, and just some of the popular press also that keeps that kind of ideal going. What are your thoughts on it?
Yeah, well, there seems to be, you know, a tradition, you know, keeping sex really under the covers in more ways than one. And, you know, the ideal that you described, I think you could probably add, you know, not very often, you know, maybe once a week, you know. And, you know, well, sex has seemed to be a topic that, you know, is... there's no freedom around it to be expressive. It's something sort of like for the woman. I mean, it's traditionally been even talked about in terms of an obligation or a duty.
Mm-hmm. And for the man, it has been the right of
right.
the husband.
Right. So I think it comes about because of our feelings about sex in general, that we restrict it to certain kinds of situations just because we want to restrict it anyway. And then, you know, in my own personal case, I can recognize a very strong religious influence on some of those values. I really distinctly recall in grade school, I went to a parochial grade school, and as early as like the second or third grade, when the nun would lead us through an examination of our consciences, one of the things she would ask us is, ask yourselves, have I had any impure thoughts? Have I allowed these impure thoughts to remain in my mind and to enjoy them? Well, you know, first of all, second graders really don't have any idea really what an impure thought is. And what immediately develops from that is that any thought about sex is impure. You know, so it's
and if you even enjoy the thought, you're bad, let
right.
alone the action.
That's right.
Unless it is in this ideal situation. Right, and that's... So you can, the outlet can be in that ideal situation,
right.
but in no other situation.
And there's, you know, there's even sometimes a failure to make the connection, you know, if, you know, it was never explained to us how to have pure thoughts about sex, I guess. So we never had that option to, you know, at least hang on to. Well, sometimes it's okay. So that whole thing. And I don't think that just has to be any kind of a certain religion. I think that general attitude is very pervasive in the mm-hmm. society and definitely restricts choice because, you know, from the inside, insofar as we internalize these values, then we, you know, there's an internal resistance to doing anything in this mm-hmm. area.
I think that I was just thinking there's a definite age limit on this that fits into the ideal that I hadn't thought about before. I think people definitely think that a free sexual expression is not for teenagers, of course. Mm-hmm. Probably if you are married from the time that you were 21 until, what would you say, the upper limit would be 35? I have some empirical evidence about this. When I present programs on sexuality, one of the things that I like to do is display about 30 photographs, and then I have people rate the photographs. Are these photographs very sexual in nature, moderately sexual, or have no sexuality component whatsoever? And I have, for example, a set of photographs that are very similar, just the heads of a man and a woman. And the heads are very close, and the people are smiling. And the only difference is one set, the man and woman appear to be about 25, 26. The other set, the people are clearly in their 60s. And people rate those photographs, and they always rate the younger couple as being at least moderately sexy. And the older couple is zero. No sexuality in this at all. In the loving, in the caring, even in the close physical contact, there is no sexual component whatsoever. I think that this leads to expectations and to norms, to limitation of choice, so that if there is an older couple, they're in their 65s, the man might feel a little bit like a dirty old man.
Unless he finds a younger woman.
Yes. That's another norm that is accepted. And the woman definitely, I would think, would not fit in into the norm, into the ideal expectations for a woman of 65 to have an active and enjoyable sex life. Mm-hmm. How about, let's put it down to the campus community. Right now, do you feel that in a campus situation, this ideal is less active? That people are allowed more choice?
I think there may be a new thing entering in now, for women at least, in that existing within a university community, which is maybe far more permissive than their home environment or their hometown. And with women, the great emphasis that is put on being popular and being liked and the great security that comes from having a steady boyfriend and all that, and having a steady boyfriend more and more meaning a sexual relationship with him, is becoming a more and more accepted thing, and you know, by the male and the, you know, and the female, but I can see that in some cases leading to a denial of choice, and that women could enter into sexual relationships with some kind of an infringement of choice, in that they have to accept the male on his terms almost, without really mm-hmm. questioning the terms themselves.
So they still more or less have their status defined by an association with a male.
Yeah. And, you know, it's changed a little, you know, the nature of that relationship.
They don't have to necessarily be married, and they don't have to have a double bed. A king-size water bed can't be all right. And maybe even a Saturday afternoon instead of after 10 o'clock. But nevertheless, it is...
Yeah, I think you still find those same kinds of limitations going on in the woman, and I'm sure in the man too, insofar as they cannot express openly to themselves or to each other their real feelings about about having sex, period, or about the kind of sex they're having. I think it's probably even today very difficult, say, for a woman to express to her lover that what he's doing is not really leaving her that satisfied, mm-hmm. or that he could improve his technique in this way. I still think those kinds of conversations, I have a feeling, are still pretty rare.
Yes.
So that kind of is, I view that as an infringement on choice, in that a choice not to have sex, but to have the best kind of mm-hmm. sex, or enjoyable mm-hmm. sex, or to think that that's something that is really within grasp, within reason.
Well, I wanted to explore some of the alternatives for women to increase their choice, and it sounds to me like we're dealing with two different kinds of choices. One of them is the kind that you were talking about, Jill, just now, that if a woman somehow found the courage to take the risk, she could choose to communicate in deeper ways, in different ways, in more ways, with someone else that is important to her. What kind of things would lead up to that? Okay, what can people do to increase their own choices? Any suggestions to meet this particular heterosexual ideal problem that we've talked about?
Well, I would say just to sit down and really try and deeply think about yourself and what you enjoy and what you really want, what you are comfortable with, not what other people around you may want you to be comfortable with, and you know, really what you want. It's got to come from yourself first, I think. And that can be done by talking to other people. There are lots of people.
I think specifically to other women.
And other women.
And find out what, if you can find a friend that you trust and share your experiences and share your thoughts and feelings about them, I think that's one way to test out some of the things you want to say and how, what words to use, how to say them.
Right. But again, that what you talked about in the beginning of the program, that can be a very difficult thing mm-hmm. to do, too, unless it's a very close friend and you've had somewhat similar conversations before. But there are certainly people in the Dean of Women's office, in the counseling centers, you know, that you could talk to also.
Yes.
Another idea is just to be informed, you know, just read mm-hmm. books yeah. and articles and just be informed about the facts, you know, physiological facts about birth control. You know, there's no reason mm-hmm. not to be informed about something that's
Yes, you can't
important.
Possibly make a choice if you don't know that it's there to be made.
Right.
Another possibility might be in just gaining an understanding of the limitations that you are, you know, at present working under. I've had conversations with close women friends of mine in which we've talked about what our mothers told us about sex. And after seeing how little that was, it sort of, you know, dawns on us a little more, well, you know, no wonder these things are hard. And just understanding where it's coming from and that it has some background. And
that you are not a dumb person or a bad person
right.
or born with some parts missing or something like that. It's simply the way you were educated about this important subject.
Yeah, right. That can be a really good way to initiate a conversation like that, is to just start out by telling funny stories about what you feared. I mean, maybe they're not so funny deep inside, but they are funny, you know.
They weren't funny at the time.
That's right.
But now we can look back.
But now you can kind of look back and laugh. And that's probably a good way to start out a conversation of that sort.
What about the more obvious problem that we started the program with, the very violent infringement on choice, specifically through rape? How can a woman increase the choices she has available to her, either to prevent a situation like that or to deal with it when it occurs?
Well, there's always, you know, learning self-defense techniques. There are very simple kinds of techniques and things that any woman can do and learn that are just really common sense, but we need to, you know, have it called to our attention that we can do that. We're working in the Dean of Women's office and with Traffic and Security on a slideshow on self-defense for women, which we hope to have done by January, so we can take that around, which will give those kinds of examples of things that you can do. We also have a rape counseling group of women who will be glad to talk to anyone who has been raped, who has been raped recently, like right now, and is wanting someone to go with her and help her through some of the situations, reporting it to the police and going to the hospital. And she would just need to call the information center which is 864-3506, and get help in that way.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I think that this evening we've covered some of the problems facing women and the infringement on their choice for expressing their sexuality. I'd like to thank our guests, Jill Whitley and Casey Ikey, and invite you to tune in next week, same time, same station, for A Feminist Perspective.